The Guardian.
We're here today to announce the first synthetic cell.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, the creation of artificial life. It has already been hailed as one of the most significant scientific breakthroughs since the splitting of the atom. But is that right?
It's an exponential increase in a tool set that can be used to help humanity.
The US geneticist Craig Venter has built the genome of a bacterium from scratch.
This is the first self-replicating species that we've had on the planet whose parent is a computer.
Venter, you'll be familiar, is the bad boy of science. Or is he a true genius who'll make trillions from his invention?
This is as much of a philosophical advance as a technical advance in science.
We have a top team in the studio to analyze the developments and discuss its ethical implications.
There are groups that thrive on opposing technological advance. What is it with us?
Also on the programme, we'll talk about the story of science, the BBC's grand project to chart the history of this podcast's most favourite of topics.
He managed his image, he was fantastic at PR, he invents the story about the apple falling, mainly so he can rubbish his rival Robert Hooke.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. You'll notice that this podcast is a bit earlier than normal, all because of that man, Craig Venter. Before we dive in with him, let's introduce our experts in the studio. The Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample, is here. Welcome, Ian.
Hi, Alok.
You had the best headline today, God 2.0. Was that meant to be there?
Did I? No, that was an accident and I won't explain it.
Also here is Michael Mosley. He's a former doctor who got bored with medicine and went on to the BBC instead. Since then, he's become an award-winning journalist and TV presenter. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning.
He's worked on luminary science programmes, including QED, Tomorrow's World and Horizon. His latest show is The Story of Science. Michael, with Science Weekly, your portfolio of remarkable science programmes is now complete. How do you feel?
I feel very good about it. And well, it's a great time to be here.
Well, we're going to talk about the story of science in just a bit. But first, a man who's about to write a new chapter in the story that Michael's telling, Craig Venter. It's taken more than a decade of work and cost around $40 million, and is being described as a defining moment in biology. Scientists at the J. Craig Venter Institute in Maryland have created the world's first synthetic life form. They built the genome of a bacterium from scratch and incorporated it into an existing cell. It's a step along the way for a raft of designer organisms that can be used to do everything from clean up oil spills to make drugs. Ian, God 2.0, what's Venter done in just a few words?
Let's brush that aside. He's created a synthetic genome by copying an existing bacterial genome. And then he's popped that genome into a bug, and it multiplies, and some of the progeny carry the synthetic genome. So that's what he's done.
Well, let's hear from the man himself. Here's Craig Venter and his team as they unveiled their discovery to the world.
Early one morning at 6 a.m., we got a text from Dan saying that now the first blue colonies existed.
March 26th, it was a Friday, and we all felt very confident that we finally were going to get this to work, because for the first time, we had a genome that we knew didn't have any lethal mutations.
So it's been a long route to get here, 15 years from the beginning. Early on, when you're working in a new area of science, you have to think about all the pitfalls and things that could lead you to believe that you had done something when you hadn't, and even worse, leading others to believe it. So early on, we developed the notion of putting in watermarks in the DNA to absolutely make clear that the DNA was synthetic. We've briefed the White House, we've briefed members of Congress, we've tried to take and push the policy issues in parallel with the scientific advances. Perhaps it's a giant philosophical change in how we view life. We actually view it as a baby step in terms of it's taken us 15 years to now to be able to do the experiment we wanted to do 15 years ago on understanding life at its basic level. But we actually believe this is going to be a very powerful set of tools. And we're already starting in numerous avenues to use this tool to perhaps make the flu vaccine that you might get next year. because instead of taking weeks to months to make these, Dan's team can now make these in less than 24 hours. So when you see how long it took to get an H1N1 vaccine out, we think we can shorten that process quite substantially. We have a program with ExxonMobil to try and develop new strains of algae that can efficiently capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or from concentrated sources, make new hydrocarbons that can go into their refineries to make normal gasoline and diesel fuel out of CO2.
It would be possible for someone to use this new technology of synthetic genomics to synthesize a pathogen, a new way to obtain pathogens that can be obtained now from laboratories, from closed facilities. We have a government infrastructure that controls access to really nasty stuff that we would not like to have fall into the hands of a potential bioterrorist.
There's been lots of controversy recently, even a court ruling about whether naturally occurring DNA is patentable. This comes up from time to time. There was the Chakrabarty decision of the Supreme Court some decades ago that said discovering new bacteria or other cells were patentable. I've never been quite comfortable with making discoveries of discovering existing life forms and claiming patents on them. But I think if we ever had an argument for something that was human-derived by starting with code in the computer and building it, I think we have a good case for a whole new approach to this. We consider there was a lot of inventiveness, a lot of inventions that went into this, and Synthetic Genomics on our behalf has filed multiple patents on various stages of this work. But it's gone through about a billion steps of self-replication, but it's currently frozen in the freezer right now. Good molecular microbiology practices, you don't keep cells growing indefinitely, but if there's a cell museum, we may donate it to it.
Craig Venter there talking about his new developments. To help us process some of the implications of Venter's work, we have Goss Micklem with us, a geneticist from the University of Cambridge. Goss, welcome. You've been listening to what Venter's had to say. Your first thoughts on this. How significant a development is this? Is this really as big as splitting the atom?
I really don't think it's as big as splitting the atom. It's clearly a landmark study. It's building in a very logical way from work that the group's published already. And you could almost argue what they've done in their previous two major publications was the really exciting thing from a scientific point of view, which was, first of all, constructing really big pieces of DNA, which is absolutely not a trivial undertaking, and then moving the genome of one bacterium to a related one. And after that, this is kind of not so surprising, and it's basically putting those two things together. Having said that, it's still it's undoubtedly a landmark piece of work.
Ian, can you give us some ideas of how big this life form, or inverted commas, is?
I think you mean the genome. I mean the DNA they put together, and bear in mind this is one chromosome essentially, and it's a million base pairs, so a million letters or so, and then they've added in four watermarks, which were about 1,000 base pairs each, the watermarks being this coded DNA, but DNA that's ignored by the organism, just to mark it as synthetic. So it's long. But it's, this is nowhere near, let's not think about doing multicellular organisms or anything bigger than that with multiple chromosomes. I mean, this is firmly in the territory of single cell.
Roughly speaking, a human genome has 3 billion base pairs in length. So this is 1 million. So it was several orders of magnitude away from that still.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely. I mean, Goss will, I'm sure we'll be able to say this, and probably should, but, different order of complexity.
And Goss, he talked in that clip about a whole range of things, from flu vaccines to eating up petrol to environmentally friendly fuels. I mean, is this stuff, is it just around the corner now?
Well, some of it's around the corner, but whether it's around the corner using this technology is a separate issue. So we, you know, the world has come a long way from the first genetic engineering experiments, which were really in the 70s, and we have a large range of mature technology, which I'm sure his institute uses on a daily basis for doing genetic engineering. And for many of these problems, it'd be far more straightforward and sensible to think of using them rather than completely resynthesizing a genome.
I think you're being a bit sensible here. I actually think it's really exciting. I personally, it gets me up in the morning, and when I read about it last night, I was busy twittering and listening to the news, and it was even better than the election.
So, Michael, this is interesting, actually, what you say, because if you look at what the Twitter reaction, the Facebook reactions have been from people interested in science and scientists, it's been, well, this is just the next step to what they were already doing, and it's not really artificial life. You're much more excited.
I love anything like this. I completely accept that Venter is somebody who likes to promote himself, and I enjoyed his lines like, this is the first life whose parent is a computer. I thought that was a very good line, though he also went on to say baby steps. That was a very brief moment, and then he went on to say how marvellous he was and everybody else was. But I just enjoy the fact that science is making a noise. I agree it probably isn't going to be splitting the atom, but then again, splitting the atom wasn't splitting the atom. When they first did it, all he was doing was knocking electrons off the atom. It took another 15 years before it actually split the atom. So you could go, oh, well, you know, Rutherford bit cocky. He sort of, you know, made horrendous claims, you know, oh, let's not get too excited about this. But I also remember when cloning, I was doing a Horizon film, and I went to see world experts who said cloning will never happen. And 2 weeks later, blimey, it happened. So I think the danger is always saying this thing is utterly uninteresting until you know, and that's what history tells you, is that an awful lot of claims turn out to be nonsense, obviously, but occasionally the ones you think are nonsense turn out to be immensely significant.
Gosh, I mean, I'm sure no scientists think that this is nonsense research, because it's published in Science, you know, one of the major academic journals of the world, and it's peer-reviewed, and you wouldn't argue that Craig Venter is a bad scientist in any way.
No, he has a long track record of doing innovative science and being controversial and a self-publicist whilst he's been doing it. But I thought actually the point that you just brought up about cloning was an interesting one. Cloning was one that if you'd asked me about 30 years ago, I would have said, it's just not going to happen. You're just not going to be able to take cells from somebody's arm and turn them into a new person. Well, of course, we haven't done it with humans yet, but and probably won't.
But you never know. Cyprus even at this moment.
But I think that this result did not have the same wow as that. So, for instance, when I heard about Dolly the sheep, that was a real deep surprise. And this, to me, is an important proof of concept that you can reconstruct whole genomes.
Goss, has the reaction from scientists been a bit conservative because this is what scientists do? They just don't want to stick their neck out to say that this is going to be the biggest thing ever, like the Venter does, because they've been sometimes been surprised by how complex things can really be and how surprising things can be.
I think it's a combination of that there's a tradition in science of not overly self-publicizing and of putting one's results forward cautiously and then hoping that people notice them and then respond accordingly.
There's also a tradition of doing absolutely the reverse. Science is as full of self-promoters as anybody else, if you look down back through history. Well, Humphrey Davy, I could cite you as probably one of the great self-promoters of all time.
Well, we'll talk about some of the self-promoters a bit later, Michael.
Okay, I'll take that one back.
Ian.
I just wanted to make a point about Venter's strategy here, just because I think it helps us work out how to judge what he's done. Now, his idea is to, through this kind of work, is to try and come up with the minimal gene set which can give you viable life. So the minimum number of genes that will give you a viable life. Once you have that minimal gene set, he then wants to bolt on additional functionality genes, if you like, so that you end up with an organism that can do something like mop up heavy metals from contaminated water and such like. And the reason he wants to do it that way, starting with a minimal genome and building up, is that your organism is optimized to do the job that you've designed it for. Now, that's his strategy, okay? And you could say that going to a minimal genome says something profound about life in itself, and that's probably a sort of philosophical and PR thing that he's interested in. Let's leave that to one side. The other alternative is the way people would do this now, where you take an existing organism, you GM it, you modify it, and you haven't optimized it exactly, but you've modified it to do the job you want. And I think how you judge this work better is to say which is the better approach. And his is very attractive and glitzy, but it may not be the best way. It may be sort of basically going through an awful lot of hurdles for no massive benefit.
But couldn't you argue that basically science should be about trying different things? That if you're always driven by the pragmatic approach, let's stick to the old tried and trusted because actually that's a much more reliable way of looking at life. That what he's doing is he's shaking it up. I come across as part of the fan club. I'm not really, but I was very impressed when he did the Human Genome Project. You know, he did kick all sorts of governments into life and got them scared and they actually reacted. People thought he was a wide boy. They probably still think he's a wide boy. But the fact is he approached it from a different way.
Yes, and I think the controversy engenders has in fact been productive in exactly that kind of way.
If you can do pretty much anything you want with biological life, and biological life has a way of evolving into all sorts of interesting and sometimes dangerous things, what happens if it does develop something dangerous and get out there into the environment?
Well, so I think one of the interesting things about the synthetic biology community as opposed to the GM crop one is that right from the beginning, ethics and this type of discussion has been at the front of the agenda. So every team has to consider the ethical aspects of what they're doing in this undergraduate competition. And I think one needs to be realistic about what can happen. So an awful lot of genetic engineering is about fixing problems, sort of boring problems about why things don't work. It's not that they've produced something sinister or dangerous. It just doesn't work. It's like building an engine that doesn't turn. And although it's very important to consider the risks, and it's definitely better to keep everything in the laboratory for the longest time possible and really think through all the issues before you would ever think of releasing an organism, the chances of something spontaneously producing something unplanned and nasty is really quite low.
But isn't that what evolution is about? Yeah. Isn't that precisely what evolution is about? 99.9% mistakes and then the 0.1%, and that's why we're sitting in the studio here, rather than being a bowl of slime somewhere.
Well, also, evolution, as you say, Michael, I mean, it kills most things. It's a vicious world out there. So these synthetically created organisms mollycoddled in a lab will just die as soon as they get out there, you would think.
Yes, I think actually it's a much... the short-term applications in synthetic biology, in my mind anyway, will tend to be inside fermenters, inside pharmaceutical companies, for instance, if you think about drug production. And that designing something that works properly in the outside world is probably a lot harder than we think. And for instance, people have been working on yeast for many years. We've been using yeast for even longer. But if you think about yeast, people were cultivating it under lab conditions for decades. And by accident, somebody discovered an entirely unknown growth form. So instead of it being a nice yellow pasty form, it turned out that it could grow in a form like a fungus with little hypha and make a little furry colony. And we had no idea that this existed. It had been hidden inside the genes of common yeast for many years. Now, out in the wild, that's probably a very useful growth mode, but inside the lab, it's not needed. Now, the problem with making a minimal organism and then thinking about putting it into the outside is we will have removed all these apparently unnecessary genes that, in fact, are very important for it keeping it alive.
Ian, one of the other things that Venter's done is to put messages into his genome, including something you can try and crack and send him the answer to.
That's right. I mean, it's kind of an essential thing to do in when you're sort of creating these sort of organisms in the sense that they are being created in Venter's mind and many other synthetic biologists' minds, is that you have to tag them in some way, watermark them. And the way you do that is by encoding useless bits of DNA, in a sense, into the genome so you can identify it pretty easily. And they put four different watermarks in. The first watermark, at the beginning of that, it basically tells you how to read the rest of the code. So this is all sort of, obviously, with DNA, you only have four letters to play with, and somehow you want to be able to spell out, 26 letters of the alphabet, the numbers 0 to 9, and have punctuation marks. And they developed a way to code all of these things. So the first watermark has a way of understanding what the rest of the code is. Then you go to another watermark, which includes a website where you can email them if you manage to crack the code. Another watermark has all the scientist names who were involved in this work. And then the fourth watermark includes some philosophical quotes from literature. And one of them was from James Joyce, to live, to fall, to triumph, to recreate life out of life, which is classic Venter. I mean, it's beautiful.
Michael,
but
does that make you love him more?
Oh, absolutely. I love anybody who can quote. I enjoy those sort of quotes. And I do think that's part of what science is about. It's basically engaging people in stuff which is not just simply factual, but which touches on your heart.
It's kind of like a treasure hunt, isn't it? It's like looking for those golden hairs in the 80s.
Oh, completely. And science is out there. It is part of the same industry that everyone else is at part of, trying to get attention.
there was one thing that struck me when he was telling me about this was, how do you know your watermark isn't going to make this bug do something odd, or at least overburden it with something? And he said that they were absolutely really worried about this, because a lot of the coding mechanisms that are out there in the scientific literature already show how to do this. They don't really take this into account. So you have to make sure that your watermark itself doesn't produce what Venter referred to as unintended biology. And basically you pepper it with stop codons, essentially, just ways of making sure that if it does start to get transcribed, it aborts pretty quickly. So none of this actually, this Joycean quote won't get turned into any kind of protein inside the bacteria.
Can you imagine some sort of, by accident, you mutate something and create...
Joycean doom virus.
The doom virus. That's the quote for today.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
So we've discussed most of the scientific issues now, and we're going to move on to some of the ethics and public attitudes. We're going to speak to Dr. Leslie Patterson of the Royal Academy of Engineering. The Royal Academy published a report last year on the public attitudes to synthetic biology and the sort of some of the ethical things that people should be thinking about. Leslie, welcome to the show. Tell me what you think the ethical, not the scientific issues should be, but where does society take this development now? Where should we be sort of taking the debate?
I think the good thing is that it's now on the nationwide consciousness. It's now reached lots and lots of people. When we did this survey, most people had never heard of synthetic biology before. And it's really important, one, that we get the awareness out there. And this is what else the people that chatted to us said about. They really want the scientists to be open about it, to tell them about their motivations, so that it's not scientists and engineers that decide how this emerging technology is going to be used, but so it's in consultation with the public. So I think that's one of the most important things, that we start the debate now. We start looking to see, is the regulation enough right now? What safety controls do we need? What licensing? And having a look at what the risks are and seeing if there's anything that can be done now to prevent those risks, or at least acknowledge that they exist.
How rare is it for a scientific discipline with so much potential to actually have these discussions before the technology is ready?
I think this has been the wonder of the synthetic biology community. They've been so open with, and a lot of the UK laboratories have, as part of their research establishment, have with them ethicists, philosophers, social scientists. The synthetic biologists themselves are getting out there and getting involved with public debate. And I think it's, one, it's marvellous. And two, I think there was a lot of lessons to be learned with genetic modification. When the technology was so advanced, it was just about to enter society. We hadn't had these public debates before. And people became very resistant, and they didn't like the fact that they hadn't been engaged in this potentially powerful technology.
That was Dr. Leslie Patterson of the Royal Academy of Engineering. Goss, you're letting sociologists and philosophers into your labs nowadays. This is all. She was very positive about it all.
It's quite surprising. Well, again, going back to the iGEM genetic engineering competition, last year we had a group of students from the Royal College of Art up to consider the design implications of what we were doing. And up until then, I didn't really understand what designers do, but they're very good at thinking through all of the social implications of what you're building. And we also had somebody from the London School of Economics who's looking at the social aspects of this as part of her PhD. And the other teams that are active in this area, notably Imperial College, which has a National Centre for Synthetic Biology, Newcastle, Edinburgh, Bristol, Cambridge, all of whom have won prizes in the iGEM competition, all are engaging with non-scientists as part of the actual team process.
Michael, is it a good idea to normalise technology like this to people so that when it comes along, it's nothing to we're worried about?
Absolutely, and because I think actually the division of science and scientists from the rest of the community really began in the mid-19th century has been incredibly unfortunate. And I think that it's important that the two are integrated, because actually that's entirely what science should be. Part of society, informed by society, it is an incredibly important cultural phenomena and people should embrace it. I think the danger is that scientists have tended to, frankly, put themselves on the pedestal, remove themselves from the debate and try and be pure about it. They need to get down and dirty.
Which goes right back to Venter, Ian.
Yeah, I just have a question for Michael. I think probably one of the best placed, although Goss, you tell me as well. It's something you come across time and time again doing this kind of job, that there are groups that thrive on opposing technological advance or technological change, whichever, if advance is too loaded in being sounding beneficial, and a lot of these things are dual use. Presumably this goes back to whatever century, where there have always been these groups who have just opposed things because they think they are going to bring about the end of the world. What is it with us?
There's always groups who have vested interests. I mean, if you go back to the 17th century, basically the Pope and the Catholic Church are not that fond of the idea that the sun is the center of the universe and not the earth. And you go on through history, and there are plenty of groups who will go and say, no, 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 this is a terrible, terrible thing. And it's very difficult to oppose, and it's difficult to change. And sometimes they're right, you know. It's probably better that the atomic bomb had not been created and dropped, but...
Well, someone was going to do it. We managed to have that entire conversation without mentioning the Pope or religion in any way. And well, that's probably a good place to stop before we start talking about this. You can leave your thoughts on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And you can hear the whole of Craig Venter's hour-long media conference in our latest Science Weekly Extra podcast. There's a link on our blog, and it should also be on your iTunes feed already. Now for the much anticipated details about your chance to see the recording of the number one science podcast on iTunes. Yes, that's us, in case you were wondering. We're taking Science Weekly onto the road. This Wednesday, that's the 26th of May, Science Weekly Live is part of an evening event held at London's Science Museum. The fun starts at 7 p.m. Our recording begins at 9, and we've been allocated a very brightly coloured room in the basement. I'll be there along with Nell Bowes and Ian Sample. Our special guest for the night will be Dr. Kevin Dutton. He's a psychologist and an expert on the science of social influence. He's just written a book called Flipnosis, The Art of Split-Second Persuasion. We want you to take part. Ask questions and clap whenever producer Andy asks you to. If you want to come, email us at science@guardian.co.uk so that we can gauge numbers, but be aware you don't need tickets to actually turn up, so just feel free to come along if you're around. All the details are on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, and also on our Facebook wall.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
It might not seem that way when you listen, but everything we talk about on this podcast is in service of one of the grandest of human endeavours. Michael Mosley's been trying to tell the tale of that endeavour on the BBC. The Story of Science is all about the culture in which luminaries including Isaac Newton and Charles Darwin made their seminal contributions to the world. Michael, we've just spent the entire podcast talking about Craig Venter, possibly in future seen as one of those luminaries, who knows. To tell us a bit about the series, it's not a traditional sort of here's what happened and here's how we know about the world and the Earth goes around the sun, etc., is it?
No, it's not. It's essentially set up as a series of questions. So what is out there, story of astronomy. Next week is actually what is life, which is incredibly relevant.
Nice and timely.
It's very timely, and I may have to just tweak the ending a bit in the light of events, because at the end I say that something like this is probably about to happen, and blimey, there it was a couple of days beforehand. So it is about a series of questions, and I think that's what science is about. But it's also about the historical, political context in which things happen, and also about the gorgeous serendipity. The discovery of DNA owes an awful lot to a discovery made by a guy called William Perkin, who's a 19-year-old living in the East End in his parents' attic, and who decides he's going to find an artificial form of quinine, a treatment for malaria. That's because the British Empire is out there. Lots of people are dying of malaria. It's the only thing that works. There is huge vested interest, huge financial interest in finding an artificial form. He actually discovers the colour mauve. Now, this is a huge moment in Victorian society because everything is suddenly able to be coloured. But it also means that people start using it for lots of other things, and somebody decides to look at the cell and chromosomes light up, and that's what they're called, chromosomes, which means coloured bodies. And that is because a guy called William Perkin, who is 19, decides to play around with coal tar in his parents' attic. And that is the wonderful joy of serendipity. But he's driven by money. He wants to make money. He wants to basically find artificial quinine so he can sell it for a hell of a lot of money to the government.
Well, what about something like the first law of thermodynamics? You cannot create or destroy energy. You can turn it from one form to another. Discovered after people wanted to just make steam engines more efficient.
Absolutely. I think that the story of science will never end, which is what makes it so wonderful. As I said, it's a series of questions, and somebody once said that science never answers one question without unpacking another 16, and I think that is actually its glory. Although an awful lot of people obviously out there find this quite frustrating because they want science to deliver definitive answers, and it almost never does. And so where Ventnor fits in, I don't know. I think it's too early to say. I think that actually what history shows you is that an awful lot of small incremental steps get made by an awful lot of people. And it's only with the wisdom of hindsight, normally about a century later, that you appreciate fully what the various people did at the different points. And then what tends to happen is you tend to fetishize one person. You go, normally a bloke, it was him what done it. Whereas the truth is there's an awful lot of before and an awful lot of after. An awful lot of people who just disappear out of history as well, who for whatever reasons just didn't publish in the right place or the right language. They published in Swedish, so they didn't get the recognition for discovering oxygen. They published in some obscure journal which nobody read. And so one person tends to get the glory.
Or if you're Leibniz, you make an enemy of Newton and get written out of history for lots of other reasons altogether.
Absolutely. I mean, Newton is an absolute archetype of somebody who was...
He's a bastard.
He was an utter bastard. He's fortunately dead, so we can't libel him. But he was also passionate about his image. He managed his image. He was fantastic at PR. He invents the story about the apple falling, mainly so he can rubbish his rival Robert Hooke, gain precedence for the idea of gravity, and he realises the power of an incredibly good story. And so that is a wonderful story, which he makes up, and everybody still sort of loves it, even though all the experts say it's nonsense. And the tree you can go and sit under, you know, it's about 50 years old, but it doesn't stop people taking a bit of it, and they're going to send it into space, I believe. But okay, the original tree certainly doesn't exist.
Well, the next episode of The Story of Science is on Tuesday, May the 25th, and it's about the story of life. So let's see if Michael can re-edit that quickly enough at the end. You can join our Facebook group, which we've handily called the Guardian Science Weekly Podcast, where you can chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall too. We'll also let you know there whenever a new podcast is uploaded. That's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our guests, Ian Sample, Goss Micklem and Michael Mosley. Next week, have we mentioned it's our first ever live recording in front of a studio audience? It's at the London Science Museum, and we'd love for you to be there. Wednesday, the 26th of May, the evening itself starts at 6:45 p.m. and we're recording our podcast from 9 till 10. Psychologist Dr. Kevin Dutton will be on the panel, along with Ian and Nell. But keep an eye out for us before that too, as we'll be roaming around with our microphones. Try to let us know if you want to come along by emailing science@guardian.co.uk, but be aware you don't actually need tickets to attend. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.